Hello, and welcome to the CEO.Digital Show. Continuing our ongoing series examining the link between technology and sustainability, today I'm speaking to a very special guest.
Hello everyone, I'm Lisa Wee, Global Head of Sustainability for Aviva.
With nearly two decades of CSR and sustainability experience, Lisa is passionate about climate action and specializes in strategy and execution for business, human rights, climate change, and social impact analysis. Having previously developed the sustainability program from the ground up at Under Armour, she can also count herself among the alumni of Oxford University, Johns Hopkins, and UC Berkeley, alongside a history of volunteering in various mentorship programs. All of which is to say, Lisa knows a thing or two about getting things done. And so now, Lisa, let me welcome you to the CEO.Digital Show. So Lisa, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I think first and foremost, it would be really, really great to dig into our main topic for today, which is sustainability. I was just wondering if you could talk us through how you first came to personally be interested in sustainability issues and then ultimately come to make a career out of that.
So after finishing my degree, my undergraduate degree, I actually decided to spend a year in rural Paraguay working on a sustainable tourism and education project. And at the time, we were seeing a lot of aid funding go down towards parts of Latin America and a big increase in funds that were coming in from large energy and extraction projects. And it made me really interested in understanding more about how that funding was really contributing to development, how it was helping both people, but also the planet. And I decided that I was going to try and make a career in corporate sustainability, which at the time, not very many people had still heard of. There were a lot of questions, and I actually went back to grad school trying to focus on that, but even at the time, there weren't any real degrees. I ended up doing a degree in international relations and economics, and I'm so excited that now there are so many opportunities in this field, but also great degrees in carbon accounting, business and human rights, ESG reporting, and more.
Wow. Such an exciting field, I think. And it's one of those things that the more I hear about, the more I understand, the more I want to know. Even now, I'd say that corporate responsibility is not really something that people talk about as much as they probably should. What do you wish more people understood about the sort of work that you do?
Just an appreciation of the breadth of the issues that we cover. So again, I started my career with a focus, very much on people and communities and how we were actually helping to drive economic development at a local level from working for a large energy company. But that really has evolved again to all the way up to making commitments around climate, that then, looks at working across the entire business. So it's a very, very broad field with opportunities to work on lots of different areas. And that's what keeps it really interesting and exciting for me. But it's also quite hard to be an expert in all of those areas, which is why I'm so glad that now we have very often the opportunity to have growing teams of people working to advance the goals.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete team effort, and there's no end of sort of specialisms that are required. Am I right in thinking you recently attended the World Economic Forum?
That's right. Yes, I was in Davos earlier in January.
Wow. I bet that was an incredible event. How did you find it? And were there any sort of key takeaways you'd like to share with our audience?
I think again, the you mentioned that sustainability is a team sport, and very often to drive change, we really need to have change at a systemic level. So that means that we need, of course, business, but we need policymakers, we need leaders across the philanthropy sector to come together. So I think, again, what I appreciate about the World Economic Forum is it's an opportunity to bring together key leaders from across all of those sectors to have some of those discussions. And I think what really stood out to me is obviously there's so much going on in the world right now from a geopolitical lens, a huge focus coming this year on global elections or elections happening around the world, I should say. But even within that frame, sustainability remains such an important priority. And in particular, you know, this year there was a focus on sustainability, but also technology, which is great since I sort of sit at the nexus of those two areas. So it was exciting to see the optimism that there is around how, in particular, improvements in technology, improvements in artificial intelligence can potentially drive greater change, but also a real focus on doing that the right way to make sure that we are, again, have the right guardrails in place to be able to draw the benefits and limit some of the risks associated with emerging technologies as well.
Yes, it feels like there's a real narrative shift happening at the front line of this sort of work. I think your average person would probably think, you know, if asked about technology and the relationship with the climate, they would probably think that, well, technology is probably to blame for an awful lot of the climate challenges we're having. And they probably wouldn't be wrong. But at the same time, it seems like technology may well be at the forefront of how we're going to solve some of those challenges now and the next phase of thinking about a more sustainable future, particularly in software. I'm aware that Aviva have some solutions that are, you know, of help for businesses trying to be more sustainable. What sort of help can Aviva provide?
Yeah, maybe it's helpful here to just provide the audience with a bit more context on Aviva. So we are an industrial software leader. We work with 20,000 customers across a very broad range of industry verticals. And we really provide them with solutions that help them to engineer, operate, and optimize their assets so that they can focus on doing what they do best, which is really providing the essentials for life as we know it. That would be your reliable, clean energy, food, vaccines, transportation, and more. So again, we work with a lot of different industries that are so foundational to life as we know it. But those are also industries that need to be decarbonized if we're actually going to make progress on achieving net zero. In fact, if you look at power and industry taken together, you know, it's over 60% of global emissions. So if we can't decarbonize those sectors, then, you know, we're not going to be able to make meaningful progress on meeting our climate commitments. So that's what I find, again, really exciting and sometimes daunting about the task ahead. But again, that's also one of the reasons I joined Aviva, because being a software company, we actually have the opportunity to help provide solutions at scale across these different industries. And that doesn't mean that we don't need to lead by example on climate. We've made our own ambitious commitments to decarbonize. But the real opportunity that we have to contribute is to have this, you know, exponential impact through developing software solutions that then help those hard-to-abate industries to decarbonize. And I mean, just one statistic from the World Economic Forum, because you mentioned it earlier, you know, that, digital solutions at scale are expected to contribute as much as 20% of the mitigation that we need of emissions by 2050. So there's a lot to do. But again, if we have these solutions in place, they're really going to help to deliver on those industries of tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very challenging deadline that the whole world is facing. And it's really important to think early and think actively about where to begin. You mentioned net zero there. So thinking of acting early and actively, what would you say is the first thing that business leaders should do in order to reach net zero?
Well, it's one of those, you know, well-known adages that you really can't manage what you can't measure, right? So I think where most people are and where we started ourselves was, of course, understanding, do we have a good grasp of our own operational emissions data? And then how do we improve on that data over time? And in industry, again, that really can be accomplished when you have the right data tracking and infrastructure in place that brings together metrics from across your operations, but then increasingly across your value chain. So you need to, again, be able to know your data, to be able to report it, and then again, to very often to see that data in context so that you can find, you know, the big opportunities and pain points to then to make reductions. And maybe if I just provide you with one example. So in the case of Toyota, for example, the car manufacturing, it was, you know, they were able to use a kind of monitoring of real-time data across their plants to reduce their energy consumption by almost 30%. But in particular, they also identified that it was the painting process that was a particularly high emissions area. And so because they had the right visibility on that data, they could then take targeted action and reduce their carbon intensity for that process by over 20%. So it's helping to you to know sort of where you stand, to get your baseline, but then also, you know, look at those areas where you want to be taking, with your limited resources, actions that are going to be quite meaningful. Because that's, again, something that we ourselves face is, I'm a sustainability leader, I have a limited budget, I need to know that I'm going to deploy resources where they're going to have the greatest impact. And it's quite hard to do that without the right data.
Absolutely. It's so important for just helping get other people onto the same track of thinking. You know, it's hard to enact change in any organization. The larger the organization, the harder it is to generate change and meaningful change. And that data can really be an invaluable tool for convincing the people that need to be convinced. Look, this is what we need to do. We're not doing enough. We need to change the way that we're doing. Do you have any advice for any listeners who might be struggling to find the data that they need in order to get buy-in on sustainability issues?
Well, I think, again, you want to, you know, start where you can. I think it's also very important not to be always on the quest for perfect data. So you will have some data, and to start by bringing that together, you know, to make decisions where you can, and then you can improve on it over time. I think that is what you're seeing, again, most companies. We're living the age now where more than 80% of, even in the UK, FTSE 100 companies have made public commitments around net zero. That means that they have established their baseline. You know, that gets you on the journey. And then you're going to be always looking for ways to improve that. Very often, that might even lead you to re-baseline, since we're in the world now of rebaselining and also getting assurance on your data. But all of this starts with having, I think, the right, you know, infrastructure in place. And I think one statistic that I think about a lot, just to help maybe the audience understand why there's still so much of a need for industry to digitalize so that they do have that good foundational layer of data. You know, only 30% of industrials have done digitalization at scale successfully. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit still to be able to take solutions that are available and bring all of that data together to really have that real-time reporting and those more accurate baselines. And again, everybody is very, very excited right now about talking about the opportunities around artificial intelligence and really in the industrial sector, that's still fairly advanced versions of machine learning. All of that requires you to have a very solid foundation of data so that, you know, essentially you are able to train models on good data. So while there's a lot of opportunity there, and again, as a sustainability leader, I think a lot about how do we make sure that we're talking about use cases and directing artificial intelligence to the right ones, to the biggest problems that we're trying to solve, you know, I think we also need to recognize that there's still a lot of low-hanging fruit and more foundational steps that need to happen for industries that will lead to those big decarbonization results.
Great answer. Yeah, thank you very much. That brings us very nicely to the subject of the cloud, and specifically the hybrid cloud. I was wondering, what's your take on how hybrid cloud will play a factor in shaping a more sustainable future?
Yeah, so of course the cloud brings with it those tremendous benefits of scale, and also we have a number of global cloud providers that have made some very ambitious and helpful commitments on renewable energy, right, and electricity that has helped to create very strong market signal that has helped again to accelerate that transition towards bringing more renewable electricity in particular online. So I think it's very helpful. What we've found, though, is that there's still not a lot of standardization for how cloud providers actually provide people with information. So that was kind of one of the areas that led us to work with the Green Software Foundation, just to make sure that we have a kind of a common approach to avoid sort of leaving customers to have to produce their own real-time estimates of cloud workloads, and really to find ways that we could more consistently provide this information, since, as I said, providing emissions data in a standardized way is pretty nascent. And that's where, with other members of the Green Software Foundation, we're really trying to standardize what we mean by green IT. What are some of the best practices for cloud, of course, but even more of ourselves looking at, not assuming that, especially in a world of hybrid cloud, which is where most of us are right now, that a lot of activity will still continue on premise. How do we make sure software is designed to be efficient? How do we make sure that we're removing unnecessary queries, that we understand how to, I would say, optimize the transfer and the movement of data across networks? A lot of that can be done, with good coding practices, but even having, again, a standard approach to doing that. When we looked at this as a software company, there was a lot of white space. And so we thought, it matters to us. It matters to us for our own emissions calculations. But we're also really interested not in just shaping our own approach here, but we're interested in driving that systems level change that I referred to earlier, which means you need alignment across industry, alignment across players. So that's where we've been doing things like developing common checklists. We're looking at our own software and grading our software against those standards. But again, working in collaboration to share our own learnings and to make those common asks, as I said, of how do we work to with cloud providers in particular, because they are, part of a big part of our future, to make sure that we're collecting and measuring the data in the same way.
Really seems like there's a theme emerging here to do with collaboration and partnership and working together on some of these issues. So really inspiring. You obviously touched on the Green Software Foundation there. For any listeners that may not be aware of it or are only just becoming aware of it, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, about sort of how you started to get involved with it and some of the other work that's going on there.
So we've been involved with them since, 2 years now. So and joined in 2022. And it really is, one of the primary groups out there that's pioneering those new standards and guidelines to reduce carbon impact of software. And so we've been using those learnings, as I mentioned, to kind of measure the energy consumption of our own on-premise products, and to develop this maturity level, a ranking system, so we can, look at the maturity level of our own technologies and help design improvements over time. Because if you think about it, a lot of companies in the software sector, we're quite focused on our downstream emissions, because very often that might be where our biggest footprint is when our customers deploy our solutions. They're going to be running them using energy, and we are high growth companies. And so to the challenge that so many of us have with scope three is, how do you decouple your long-term growth plans from your emissions? Which means you have to talk about emissions intensity, and you have to find a way to make sure that your products, as you continue to grow your business, you know, that your emissions are growing at a significantly slower rate over time. So that's kind of where, again, we're interested in looking at this from an Aviva perspective, but really much more from an industry perspective. How is everybody who, you know, is in the technology sector and keen to be growing their business doing that in the most responsible way, with a focus on making sure that we are providing low carbon solutions and reducing the emissions intensities of our own offerings, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And yeah, really, really great work, and lovely to know that that's going on and that you're thinking about those kinds of things. It would be wonderful to hear that. I expect you're probably on much more on the front line than a lot of our listeners might be in terms of emerging technology, frontier solutions that will help to accelerate and validate sustainability initiatives. I'd love to hear if there's any kind of brand new, exciting technology that people might not be aware of that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've talked a lot about the software itself, and again, the how we think about the emissions associated with that. But what we're so excited about at Aviva is obviously being responsible with that regard, but also making sure that we are helping our customers to decarbonize at scale. And that's really where, maybe if I'll, again, give some specific examples, because sometimes when you talk about software, it can all get a little bit nebulous, or seem nebulous. I mentioned this earlier, we work with a number of sectors, but energy is so foundational to so much of the world that we know, and 3/4 of the world's energy is actually designed using Aviva software. So this is a sector that you know, we know well, we value the partnerships, and we are seeing a big transformation. And when we think about how those energy players are currently using our solutions, there's really 3 different ways. You know, first of all, and this reflects back some of the earlier comments, they're really looking for ways to decarbonize the existing value chains and infrastructure that's in place. And they're looking to do that in ways that they can remain profitable and balance that trade-off. Sometimes that means, again, it might be more costly in the short term, but you know, long-term profitability is important because they have to be able to do 2 things. They have to be able to reinvest in technologies that are going to accelerate the energy transition and that are commercially viable now. So that would, you know, very often be renewables at scale, advanced biofuels. Now we're seeing a lot more around small modular nuclear. You know, technologies that are available. But then they're also looking at how do they, you know, reinvest in technologies, those frontier technologies you mentioned, that push out the frontiers of the whole energy system as we know it. And that's really where we're seeing a lot of excitement around low carbon hydrogen, carbon capture and storage, and some of these advanced synthetic e-fuels. And that's really about creating a new energy infrastructure and energy system. And the reason that, again, digital solutions have a really key role to play is that they allow you to create these digital twins. And a digital twin, maybe to, again, to try and make it more visual, we talk about it as cutting the cost of curiosity, because essentially you're modeling different processes, chemical processes that then feed into how you design and operate your plant. And historically, you know, you might have been doing that, you know, back in the day on, you know, with pen and paper, but then even in early design, it was very hard to see how if you changed one variable, that would have knock-on effects on the whole system. But now we're able to create these, you know, completely digital models that allow you to to, you know, first of all, using the power of cloud very often, connect all of your talent and all of your data. So I'll give you an example. Aker Carbon Capture is one of our customers. They were looking to try and help do carbon capture and storage at scale in a viable way. And they had to bring down the cost curve. So by deploying a digital engineering solution, first of all, they could connect all of their world-class engineers. They could bring them together to problem solve on, you know, one of the biggest ways to bring down costs is to modularize a business. And they couldn't be developing these large custom carbon capture and storage units. They were able to look at the data and basically find different options for a small carbon capture unit, the optimal medium size, the optimal large size, and really you know, cut down their costs by about 90% compared to what they originally had in their design model about a decade ago. And they were able to bring up the speed to market and get their product to market 50% faster. And they were able to have a viable business stream, which they wouldn't have had before. And I think this is important because I think what we're really excited about is the idea that, you know, with the energy transition, you really are going to have to find new business models, new ways of operating. And if you need to do that again in a way that balances sustainability with being able to scale. So you've got to get the economics right. And that's very often where, you know, these digital models that allow you to see these variables, that allow you to bring in collaborate together are going to get you there. So that's just one example.
And that's a great example. Some of the statistics you mentioned there are absolutely staggering. So yeah, really, really good. Thank you. It's great to hear this sort of, I don't know, a little bit of positivity around it. Obviously, sustainability issues and the climate crisis, it can be scary, I think, for a lot of people to educate themselves on and to think about in enough detail that would then require us to move forward. So at any time there are these sort of these little doors opening up, I suppose, these avenues of hope that we can explore. I really, really love hearing about that, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. We're nearly at the end of our time, Lisa, which is a real shame because I'm really enjoying this conversation. But I'd love to know, do you have any more sort of good news, anything that you're really, really excited about that you would like to spread the word on for our listeners?
Look, you know, you mentioned it. There's obviously a lot in the news today that might not be as encouraging as you think. But I really encourage folks, if you're not familiar with it already, to get up to speed on S-curves in the sense of positive tipping points as well. Actually, the University of Exeter has done a lot of great work on this that really shows that very often we underestimate just how quickly change and transformation can happen once it gets going. You're seeing that a lot right now with the adoption of EVs and how quickly that's moved. You also saw that was a, you know, big driver of what helped bring down the costs of wind and solar over time. So, you know, I think it's important that that there is change that's happening, and once it kicks off, you can actually move very, very quickly. So it's a good resource to follow and to read up on if you're not familiar with it.
Fantastic. Thank you. And while we're on that subject, is there anywhere else you can point our listeners who would like to educate themselves a little bit more? Anything to listen to read, any documentaries, anything that you think might be of use?
Well, again, on the Aviva front, I know we've spent a lot of time, you know, working with the Green Software Foundation, so it is a great resource. We also, again, think a lot about the customers and you know, in our own sustainability report, we cover a lot of those stories for folks who want to learn more there. And I think then on the cloud in particular, I think a documentary that actually inspired our team to start asking a lot of questions was by the BBC, was the data overload and documentary just looking at cloud and what it means in terms of the growth of cloud and the data centers that underpin it. And I think it's interesting. And I think you're now seeing that also play out with a lot more governments and countries looking to regulate the environmental footprints associated with data centers to make sure that, of course, they need to run with renewable power, but they also need to be getting much, much more efficient in terms of heating and cooling so that the overall footprint of these data centers is reduced over time.
I can't wait to see what happens next. Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to thank Lisa Wee for her time on the show, and thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to read more about sustainability for the tech world, why not visit ceo.digital for articles, other podcasts, and more. Don't forget to subscribe to our feed wherever you get your podcasts, and keep an eye out for more episodes in future. Until next time, thanks for listening.